this week on Capitalism, Race and Democracy.
It's because of the austerity measures that the government had undertaken, including increasing taxes and introducing new taxes without public participation and directly deducting those taxes from our salaries.
Young people in Kenya rebel against the U.S.-supported IMF and World Bank austerity measures implemented by the Kenyan government.
2 weeks after an attempted coup in Bolivia failed, Cuba announced that it had thwarted a plot to sneak arms and ammunition into the country from the U.S.
While the talking heads in the U.S. decide if Joe Biden is mentally competent to run for re-election, it's clear that someone is still in charge of the U.S. regime change machinery, especially here in the Americas.
Media constitutes an important front in the battlefield for Venezuela, softening up the public for regime change.
As elections approach in Venezuela, the U.S. is pouring resources into supporting the opposition candidate Edmundo González, aiming to end incumbent President Nicolas Maduro's anti-imperialist rule.
If you don't know who you are, then you can't fight for what you believe in that you have to fight for, which is your nation. I think that young people need to learn about their culture.
Afro-Puerto Rican independence fighter Dilcia Pagan transitions at 77. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. Young Kenyans have taken to the streets to protest privatization and austerity measures imposed by the IMF and World Bank and implemented by the Kenyan government. 2 weeks ago, Kenyan healthcare workers went on strike nationally, and Kenyan police shot the union president. Mercy Mabiwi, national treasurer of the Kenyan Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists and Dentists Union, spoke with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to, shed some light on what's happening in Kenya, what's been happening there, and how it's really impacting Kenyan workers.
Right.
Yeah. And how it's playing into this whole global, issues that are just emerging across the globe with us facing austerity measures and very bad policies that are very anti-people. Yeah.
Well, your union recently called a national strike. Why don't you talk about why you called that strike, what the issues were in that strike, and what happened during the strike?
All right. So I'll start by giving a brief history of our union, which is just around 13 years old now. It's the first doctors' union in Kenya, was founded in 2011. We've had three successful nationwide strikes. This was the third one that lasted 56 days. Our strikes have been around getting recognition by government, who's been the major employer of doctors in the country. Our second strike was about getting our collective contract or CBA signed. And this strike was really about having that contract implemented by government. But it was triggered by two events. So one event that triggered it and made us call for it at the time when we called for it was one, the government has always had the responsibility of training medical doctors. And this means that they are responsible for ensuring that they are placed, they get internship placements, and then they are paid for the work that they do during their internship. However, with this new administration, they've had these efforts to first of all, degrade the entire internship training process by calling our doctors who have graduated not doctors, but rather students, but at the same time still expecting them to provide direct patient care and take responsibility for patient outcomes. Of course, we did not agree to this because within our collective agreement, we have clear, agreements on who a medical intern is, what is expected of them, but also what the employer's obligations are towards the intern. And so the government in a very sneaky, malicious way, decided to reduce the interns' salaries by a whooping 70%. And issued letters to place these interns with that salary deduction. We did not agree with that move. And so we called for mass demonstrations and protests across the country to call the government to order. Now, during one of these protests, of course, we are dealing with a very repressive regime in Kenya. Our Secretary General was shot at by a tear gas canister that hit his head, got him injured. He had suffered massive brain injuries. And so it is in the background of this that we realized that this is a government that will not implement our collective agreement, not just the part about the interns, but they had reneged on everything that we had agreed on. And they were continuing to oppress and suppress us. And so the second thing that triggered the strike, so there was the shooting of our Secretary General, and mainly because the interns were not going to be placed and paid their salaries as was agreed. But secondly, it's because of the measures, the austerity measures that the government had undertaken, including increasing taxes and introducing new taxes without public participation, and directly going ahead to begin deducting those taxes from our salaries. And so we had moved to court as a union to challenge that. We got a court ruling that declared those new taxes, housing levy tax, a new health tax, that was declared unconstitutional. But the government refused to stop the deductions. And so we went on strike demanding that the government respects court orders, adheres to them, and implements them. So two things concerning our CBA, but in the grand scheme, the new taxes and the new austerity measures that they were introducing that were clearly unconstitutional. And so we called for a strike, a nationwide strike, on 13th of March, having these demands amongst other demands. Of course, our main demands were centered around what had not been implemented in a collective agreement, including the issue about taxation that was really affecting not just doctors in Kenya, but all public service workers employed by government at all levels.
And the issue of privatization and austerity of public services, is this an important issue in Kenya?
Oh, this is a very important issue in Kenya. And when you see, for example, our strike that we went on the 56 day long strike, we've had other healthcare workers going on strike in the country. The clinical officers who in the US are equivalent to physician assistants just ended their 95-day long strike. And so the health sector is facing a lot of protests, a lot of strikes by health workers, and it's being driven by the massive privatization of healthcare that's being undertaken in our country that is having this ripple effect on public services, because now that government is actively pursuing the privatization of healthcare, it has reduced its focus and funding of the public health sector. And so we are seeing deteriorating standards in terms of patient care, in terms of availability of services, but also in how the healthcare workers are being treated. And so it's a perennial problem that keeps growing over the years. Every year we are having strikes, we are having issues. Coupled with that is massive corruption in government, in the health sector, where government is entering into these very crazy deals with corporations from rich countries to invest in healthcare infrastructure and buy equipment that are obsolete, that are not useful to us. But really, privatization of healthcare in Kenya is something that is totally changing the healthcare landscape in the country and having devastating impacts on patients and also on workers. And it's not that being done directly that government is selling out, that government or public healthcare facilities are being taken over by private facilities. No, it is in the legislation, in the policies that are being adopted right now in the country that have caused an increase and sort of monopolization of healthcare provisioning. Just 10 years ago, 70% of healthcare provisioning in Kenya was publicly managed. Right now, the statistics have changed and 60% of healthcare provisioning in Kenya is being managed privately.
And as you know, in the United States, you have private control of healthcare, and there are millions of people without healthcare. It's the highest cause of bankruptcy for people in the United States, not being able to pay their healthcare bills. Are you saying that now American and European companies are trying to do the same thing in Kenya that has been happening in the United States?
Yes, we have clearly, and it's been documented. Now we have, I think, 3 reports that have been made public about the involvement of US-based private equity firms, development finance institutions, the International Finance Corporation investing in healthcare in Kenya, but not just investing, but actually financializing the privatization of healthcare in Kenya. And these investments are really coming with a lot of challenges because of the type of management models that they are introducing into the healthcare setting in Kenya. So first of all, 80% of Kenyans still depend and rely on healthcare, publicly funded healthcare, because we only have a very limited healthcare insurance cover by the National Health Insurer. But what we are now seeing in Kenya is these hospitals that were once small and very isolated, they are now merging and, you know, into groups of hospitals that are centrally managed and have they just have management practices that are not anything near what has been the practice in Kenya. But we feel like what has been happening in the US is being exported into our countries. And the unfortunate thing is they're extracting profits from poor people, because even those who patronize these hospitals either have to exhaust their insurance cover or pay out of pocket. And there are already reports out there in the public of what's happening in these hospitals, how patients are being detained for days in hospitals, how dead bodies are being detained in hospitals, and families being made to fundraise to pay very huge hospital bills. We are already having reports about workers, healthcare workers, being given targets. You know, you have to make this number of, you have to request this number of tests. You have to, you know, prescribe this kind of medications if you're to get your salary at the end of the day. But worse off is the kind of labor practices that we are seeing. You know, for the very first time in our country, we are having very highly skilled doctors being employed on extremely short-term contracts, 1 week, one day, show up to work, do your work, go back home, get paid at the end of the day. You get a 1-month contract and it's reviewed at the end of the month. Did you meet our targets? How many patients did you admit? How much drugs did you, you know, prescribe? How many tests did you request? If you did not meet our targets, go home. We are getting someone else on board. And this is happening, and some of them are giving contracts that are very explicit. You are employed on a short-term contract and you're not allowed to become, you know, join a union or become a member of a union. Now, these are management practices that are very unique to our setting, because traditionally, healthcare has been one of those sectors in the country that are considered sensitive and also guarantee human security. But this new model that is very profit focused, that has commercialized, you know, patients, is just bringing with it a lot of challenges, even for our own doctors, who are now, in addition to having to struggle to survive, are also having to deal mentally with this dehumanization that is that's going on. And this practice, these investments are supported by development finance institutions, by World Bank, by the International Finance Corporation, which has supported the Kenyan government to come up with reports that demonstrate the business opportunities in healthcare in Kenya for investors to come and invest. They have published these reports. They have invited investors to come on board. And now we have healthcare corporations from the US investing massively in Kenya, private equity firms from the US-based private equity firms investing in Kenya, carrying out the profits that they're making and taking them to their stock, you know, to the New York Stock Exchange. They're not investing whatever it is in Kenya. They have had our government, our legislatures pass legislation that allows them to evade taxation and just make profit. They get away with it because we as a country have very weak enforcement, you know, capacity. We have labor laws. We have laws that protect health, patients. We have laws that protect workers, but it's very difficult for a poor country such as ours to fully enforce some of these laws. Our labor inspectorate unit is poorly resourced. In a city like Nairobi that has 5 million people, we only have one labor inspector who's responsible for inspecting every workplace in the entire city every day and reporting and enforcing. It's not possible. And so that is how these weaknesses, these loopholes in our mechanisms are being exploited, you know, by these profiteers, and they're just getting, you know, they're just ripping. But this kind of thing is now manifesting in the kind of unrest that we are seeing in Kenya's health sector, because the public sector, due to underfunding, is collapsing. But Kenyans cannot afford the alternative, which is private healthcare. You know, they cannot. And I talked about corruption, very rampant in the health sector. And why am I saying that? We have a national health insurance fund that is public, that collects funds from the public. So public servants are deducted a monthly amount of money that goes into that insurance. Informal workers contribute a certain amount every month. But up until this year, the report that comes out of the National Hospital Insurance Fund demonstrate that the fund pays more reimbursements to private healthcare facilities as opposed to public healthcare facilities. And these facilities negotiate the reimbursements. They renegotiate rates directly with the National Hospital Insurance Fund. So we see public money going directly into private, you know, these private facilities. And so they don't care whether a poor person cannot come to pay. They just are guaranteed that even if you will not pay, that little money that is guaranteed for you in the National Insurance, National Health Insurance Fund will come to them. And once it's exhausted, you go look for care elsewhere. They're done with you. They cannot admit you. They cannot provide care. They cannot do anything. And that is why, first of all, they are turning away emergencies. If you cannot pay in an admission fee, then you will not get emergency care. Secondly, if you're unable to pay your hospital bills, they detain you. They'll detain your dead person until you raise money as a community, come and pay them, and then get discharged, you know? And so it's a very, it's an extremely dangerous undertaking. It's an extremely dangerous experimentation for us in our poor country, you know? Because now we are having a mental health crisis amongst our healthcare workers. It's overwhelming. I talked to our doctors who are in the private sector. The last time we had a meeting with them, they were like, our sector is brutal. You have got to figure out how to survive in this sector as a healthcare worker, as a doctor, and this is a doctor, a specialist, who's telling you, I am afraid of becoming, I'm even afraid of talking about the union, because if they get wind of this, I'll go home and I won't have a job at the end of the day.
That was Mercy Mabiwi, National Treasurer of the Kenyan Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists and Dentists Union, speaking with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. That was Siru, Feel the Sounds of Kenya. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. While Democrats decide whether Joe Biden is mentally competent to run for re-election, it's clear that someone is still in charge of the U.S. regime change machinery, which has been humming along at its usual intensity, particularly here in the Americas. Pacifica's Don DeBar spoke with Nicaragua-based journalist Stephen Sefton.
2 weeks after an attempted coup in Bolivia failed, Cuba announced that it had thwarted a plot to sneak arms and ammunition into the country from the U.S. Cuba's Interior Ministry announced that it was detaining nearly three dozen people in a broader scheme authorities say sought to destabilize the government. The U.S. State Department said it was aware of the most recent allegations. For more on that and the most recent happenings in Latin America and the Caribbean generally, we go to Esteli, Nicaragua, to speak with journalist Stephen Sefton. Stephen?
Well, a lot of people are still trying to work out what happened in Bolivia with what seems to have been very clearly some kind of coup attempt. But then subsequent to that, there have been these suspicions aroused by declarations, in particular by the former president of Bolivia, Evo Morales, that it was some kind of confection, that it was some kind of setup by Luis Arce to try and turn around what his low popularity or relatively low popularity in Bolivia in the run-up to the elections later this year. And of course, there's this very fierce conflict between President Arce and former President Morales over whether or not Evo Morales is going to be allowed to stand as a candidate. There's a lot of, well, I wouldn't say confusion, but certainly controversy around the events of what to most people seemed like a genuine, if extremely inept and incompetent coup attempt in there in Bolivia.
Well, not quite as bad as the one that they charged Trump with in 2017, where it was led by a guy with horns and no guns.
Right. Yeah. And in Bolivia, the army officers concerned got a tank to break down the gates of the country's legislature, and they posted troops on the streets. So I don't know how they'd have dealt with that in the United States.
Didn't the people overwhelm them?
Yeah, and there was a massive mobilization of people, including people who were encouraged to resist the coup by Evo Morales, you know. And so, but it was a very strange episode, Don. It was not an entirely convincing coup attempt because it was so incompetent, and it fell apart with under 4 hours. Anyway, and that's part of the context that people are still trying to come to grips with here in Latin America, trying to work out what happened. But that's in an overall context, which looks very positive for Venezuela. Venezuela's having its presidential elections on, and I think it's general elections, so there'll be other elections taking place apart from the national presidential elections. But they have their elections there on July the 28th, and all the signs are that Nicolas Maduro, as long as the results from the opinion polls turn out to be more or less accurate, it looks as though Nicolas Maduro is going to win very easily in those elections, because as usual in Venezuela, the opposition has not been able to put together a convincing candidate. And their policies are hopelessly unappealing to the general electorate. and that the overall economy is doing much, much better. It's made an incredible comeback from the very low moments of 3 or 4 years ago as a result of the unilateral coercive measures, which are illegal, of course, applied by the United States and the European Union. And the Venezuelan economy has managed to diversify its productive activities, so it's not so dependent on oil production, but oil production too has increased very much. It's over 900,000 barrels that they're producing now, which is a huge improvement over their production levels of the last couple of years. So everything looks set fair for a good result, a successful result for President Maduro and his government team.
Looks like everyone that's not Maduro, there's five other candidates. And so I would assume even if there were substantial opposition, that it would be divided at least in two or three parts, if not five. And that's been sort of the hallmark of the opposition there anyway, right? They can't.
Yeah, they've always been divided. They've never been able to put up a convincing unitary candidate, with the possible exception of, I think it was in 2013, after the terrible news of the death of Comandante Hugo Chavez, when Henry Capriles was the candidate, and he did quite well, and he almost won. But Nicolas Maduro managed to squeeze out a victory. And I think that's one of the reasons why the United States and the European Union have been so relentless and frankly sadistic in the application of their sanctions, which have been so damaging and caused a serious amount of loss of life directly as a result of the sanctions. But that period is now over, and it looks as though the Maduro government is going to have a very successful election on July the 28th. And something else that's happening this month that also reflects the extraordinary resilience of the revolutionary movements that have resisted United States efforts to overthrow their governments. They successfully resisted in Bolivia this latest attempt after the successful coup of 2019. They resisted the latest coup in Bolivia. Looks as though Nicolas Maduro is going to have a successful election at the end of the month. And here in Nicaragua on July 19th, we now have the 45th anniversary. We're getting ready to celebrate the 45th anniversary of the Sandinista Popular Revolution. And an opinion poll came out yesterday showing that Daniel Ortega has over 80% personal approval. Over 80% of the population are satisfied with the direction that the government's taking the country. 90% approval for the police and the army. And this is not some kind of Mickey Mouse opinion poll. It's one of the most respected opinion poll companies or survey companies in all of Central America. So that that gives you some idea of the solidity of support for the revolution here. And we'll see the vindication of Nicolas Maduro at the end of this month. And it looks as though it's going to be more problematic in Bolivia because of the division among leadership. But and the overall support for the progressive, and I regard the most revolutionary parties in Bolivia, is very, very strong.
They have so many contradictions in all of the countries of the world, really, in terms of class and power relations generally, and education and development of the area where people live and all of this. And we've had an ebb and flow where, revolutionary governments or popular governments come to power. The United States and or others do everything possible to thwart that. Next thing you know, you have like a betrayal, for example, in Ecuador of Correa by Lenny Moreno and of the socialist project there. The struggle, attempted coup in Nicaragua, attempted coups in Venezuela, what we've been speaking about with Bolivia the last few weeks. And now we have on the ground what we have, revolutionary governments in Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Bolivia, and leftist or leftish government in Brazil. And the loss of some of these other countries, and also Uruguay, for example, too.
Yeah, Colombia as well. I mean, Petro, yeah. I regard Petro as progressive.
And so, I don't know. Looking at all of this, how would you say we are, the left is poised, to make some advances?
Well, I don't see, in some ways, they've made their case, right? They've been very successful against every kind of obstruction and attempt to destroy their political processes. And if you compare what their success with what's happening in Argentina under Javier Milei, and the poverty in Argentina has jumped to 55%. You know, this is a country that's a member of the G20 and the, and I understand it's a member of the OECD. They have 55% poverty, you know, and their gross domestic product has fallen just in this last quarter. It's fallen 5%. You know, that's a result of the neoliberal policies imposed by Javier Milei. So there's no contest in terms of are the political processes of the revolutionary government successful or not. They're exceptionally successful in stark contrast to the neoliberal policies in countries like Ecuador, Peru, Argentina, and so on. And so, and of course, we should also bear in mind the stunning success of Claudia Sheinbaum in Mexico.
Right.
What an extraordinary electoral victory that was. I think the left is in a very strong position, Don.
That was Nicaragua-based journalist Stephen Sefton speaking to Pacifica's Don DeBar.
Soy lo que dejaron, soy toda la sobra de lo que se robaron. Un pueblo escondido en la cima, mi piel es de cuero, por eso aguanta cualquier clima. Soy una fábrica de humo, mano de obra campesina para tu consumo. Frente de frío en el medio del verano, el amor en los tiempos del cólera, mi hermano. El sol que nace y el día que muere, con los mejores atardeceres. Soy el desarrollo en carne viva, un discurso político sin saliva. Las caras más bonitas que he conocido, soy la fotografía de un desaparecido, la sangre dentro de tus venas, soy un pedazo de tierra que vale la pena una canasta con frijoles, soy Maradona contra Inglaterra anotándote dos goles, soy lo que sostiene mi bandera, la espina dorsal del planeta en mis cordilleras, soy lo que me enseñó mi padre, el que no quiere a su patria no quiere a su madre, soy América Latina, un pueblo sin pierna pero que camina. Oye,
tú no puedes comprar al viento, tú no puedes comprar al sol, tú no puedes comprar la lluvia, tú no puedes comprar el calor, tú no puedes comprar las nubes, tú no puedes comprar los colores, tú no puedes comprar mi alegría, tú no puedes comprar mis dolores, tú no puedes comprar...
Calle 13, Latinoamérica. Venezuela goes to the polls on July 28th of this year to choose a president for a six-year term beginning on January 10th of 2025. The second term of incumbent President Nicolas Maduro has continued the radical transformation that began under Hugo Chavez. At a recent webinar hosted by the Orinoco Tribune and the International Manifesto Group, Alan McLeod, senior staff writer for Mint Press News, explained how media coverage of the elections is playing a part in the U.S. hybrid war against Venezuela.
Venezuela is hosting presidential elections on July 28th. There are 10 individuals vying for the position, including 9 in opposition to incumbent President Nicolas Maduro, who heads a coalition of 13 leftist groups. However, Maduro isn't just fighting against 9 other candidates. He's also fighting against an intense campaign from Western corporate media who are really desperate to either unseat him through the electoral process or undermine or taint his victory as fraudulent. Venezuelans often used to talk a lot about una guerra mediática inside their own country, but the media war from outside is just as real. It does seem that Washington, everyone there, from pundits to politicians alike, have coalesced around the 74-year-old retired diplomat Edmundo González and anointed them as their candidate du jour. And the coverage of González in Western media has been glowing, to put it mildly. So CNN, for example, describes him as a wildly popular and quiet, bird-loving grandfather full of, quote, poise and calm. And they talk about how people see him as a, quote, grandfather of the nation kind of figure who could usher in a new era after the political violence of the last decade, end quote. Of course, they don't talk about who is doing that political violence or anything like that, but we'll leave that aside. And of course, other corporate media, all with incredible access to González suddenly, have done the same. They all mention that he was a career diplomat who retired in 2002, but not one that I've seen has mentioned the reason why he retired in 2002, which was he was forced out after he enthusiastically backed the coup against Hugo Chavez, which installed Pedro Carmona, a very Trumpian figure, a business leader, as dictator. And Gonzalez really, while he's being presented as an independent, he is really very much taking so many of his lines from the extreme right, from Maria Corina Machado especially. And from what I've seen, Western media can't really decide whether Gonzalez is going to romp home to victory or be squeezed out. So the Wall Street Journal, for example, reported that he has a lead of 20 points in the polls. But the New York Times recently just wrote that his hopes of actually winning are slim to slight. Why is this? Well, this follows a very well-established pattern for corporate media covering Venezuelan elections, which is to build up whatever opposition candidate they prefer as an unstoppable freight train rolling towards success, but poisoning the well beforehand, claiming that if he does lose, it can only be because a patently fraudulent election process has stopped them from achieving power. And this is because it is anathema to corporate media to admit that there is a support base for socialism inside Venezuela, precisely because they spent decades either pretending these people simply don't exist or demonizing them whenever they can. And media coverage of these elections has really fallen into very much the same tropes as we've seen time and time again throughout the last couple of decades. The main one being that there is a courageous opposition fighting against a despotic strongman. In fact, you really could just change around the names of the protagonists and just run stories from 2018, 2013, or earlier. So, you know, for example, in 2013, the media presented a far-right figure, Leopoldo Lopez, as a courageous left-leaning moderate. And in one very infamous Newsweek article, even described him as having twinkling chocolate-colored eyes and high cheekbones. The article was called "Leopoldo Lopez Gives Venezuela the Image of a Revolutionary Who Has It All." The media this time, certainly in a few previous years, has really given up any semblance of balance, and it has been openly and blatantly calling for military action against Venezuela. And I'll show you a few of those examples right now. The New York Times printed this one: "Venezuela is a disaster. Time for a coup? Question mark." The Washington Post: "The odds of a military coup in Venezuela are going up, but sometimes coups can lead to democracy." Should the United States attack Venezuela? Wrote the New York Times. Again, Venezuela's path to democracy: pay off the military. Wrote the Times in 2019. Foreign policy was perhaps even more blatant. "It's time for a coup in Venezuela," ran their headline. And one last one from the Globe Post: "Venezuela's Maduro will go. It's just a matter of time." And of course, when those coups were tried and failed, the media had to come up with some sort of explanation for it. And they went with this in the Washington Post: "Is what's happening in Venezuela attempted coup? First, define coup." So they basically just said, actually, there was no coup after calling for one for years and years. Since it didn't come out the way they wanted, they said, actually, this wasn't a coup. So as part of my research for my PhD and my book, I actually interviewed a good number of journalists who produce most of the English language content on Venezuela for Western audiences. And what I got from talking with them was that they're actually a very small group of individuals, and they see themselves as really the intellectual shock troops of democracy fighting against authoritarianism in the form of Chavez or Maduro. So one, for example, the New York Times' Anatoly Kriminayev, he described himself to me as a, quote, mercenary for hire, end quote, and openly bragged about how he deliberately inserted fake or wildly exaggerated news into the public sphere. He described this as practicing, quote, what he said were sexy tricks. And he even gave me one example. There was a story a while back that condoms in Venezuela cost $750. This was completely untrue, as the ninth paragraph of the story did actually make clear. But if you just read the headline, as most people do, and the first few paragraphs, you would have come up with a very different conclusion. Actually, the truth was that a whole box of condoms in Venezuela cost $8, which was about the same as in the UK or the US at the time. But how is that going to generate a story and generate hate towards a government? It's simply not. And so foreign journalists working for establishment media overwhelmingly see themselves as sometimes having to bend the truth in order to get their desired outcome, which is regime change. And they were very open about this to me. Overwhelmingly, they live in a small bubble of privilege, in penthouses in Altamira, in eastern Caracas, and they go to garden parties at the weekend. They live, for the most part, in gated communities with armed guards, and they rarely, if ever, venture out into the more popular areas. And even if they did, a good proportion of Western journalists inside Venezuela can't actually even speak Spanish, so they can't realistically interact with the bottom 90%+ of the population. And so to them, it seems that everybody hates the government because everyone in their circles does. And that includes all the people in the newsroom, which I found were really hotbeds of opposition support and activism. Almost all Western sources do employ local Venezuelan journalists, but not from places like the Orinoco Tribune. Much more likely, they're coming from places like El Nacional or El Universal. These are legacy outlets who played a crucial role in the 2002 coup against Chavez. And those who do not conform to this sort of Chavez or Chavistas are the source of all our problems, that narrative I pushed out. So I did speak to one LA Times journalist who covered Venezuela, and he said that in the newsroom, there was a clear sense that this guy, he meant Chavez, was a threat to democracy. And we really need to be taking these opponents' sides and getting that perspective out there, he said. And his colleague, he was told, said that we have to get rid of the government. I also spoke to one Financial Times journalist who did not share the same sort of opinion on the matter. And he told me, he said, quote, "I just never even pitched stories that I knew would never get in. What you read in my book would just never, in any form, get into the Financial Times. And I knew that, and I wasn't stupid enough to waste my time pitching it. I knew it wouldn't even be considered. After I got knocked back from pitching articles, I just stopped. It was complete self-censorship," end quote. So ultimately, why is this happening? The short answer is that in a capitalist system, media are the agents of the capitalist class, and they want to see the end of any attempts to build socialism inside Venezuela. And because it's refused to toe the line, Venezuela has been the target for the US empire for more than two decades now. The US has spent vast sums of money and resources attempting to achieve regime change there. This has included funding NGOs, opposition parties, social movements. It's included unilateral coercive measures that have taken the lives of tens of thousands of people and forced millions more to leave. We've seen attempted coup d'etats and more. But little of this would be at all palatable to the American public if the country was not so demonized first in our media. And that's the real crucial role that has been so important to the US empire. That's what the media play. Media constitutes an important front in the battlefield for Venezuela, softening up the public for regime change. And so I'll finish just by reminding you that before they send in the tanks, they always send in the journalists.
That was Mint Press News senior staff writer Alan McLeod speaking at a webinar titled Venezuela Chooses: What is at Stake in the Coming Elections? You can find it on the International Manifesto Group's YouTube channel. That was Un Solo Corazón, Venezuela by Bituaya. Afro-Puerto Rican independentista Dilcia Pagan spent nearly two decades as a U.S. political prisoner until her release in 1999. Dilcia was one of the founders of the 1970s show Realidades on WNET New York, the first Puerto Rican program on public television. She was also a member of the Young Lords. While working as a TV producer on several stations in New York and Boston, she joined the clandestine Puerto Rican paramilitary organization Armed Forces of National Liberation, FALN. In a 2005 interview with J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio, Dilcia gave a brief history of the revolutionary Puerto Rican independence movement.
This is Dilcia Pagan, former Puerto Rican political prisoner on the Block Report.
You're listening to another edition of the Block Report. We right here in Harlem, New York. I'm here and I'm honored to have with me Ms. Dilcia Pagan of the FALN, Puerto Rican Independista. Did 20 years. How you doing, ma'am?
I'm doing very, very well now that I'm here for the first time over 26 years and a half and getting ready to greet all my people of love and solidarity.
Yes, ma'am. You just had a real strong message. I just came in for a second, and what I heard you say is that we're not going to get free by just writing books and other stuff. It's going to really take organizing and getting down. Can you expand on that? And why did you say that here?
Well, I say it wherever I speak because now that I'm off parole, I can speak anywhere I'm invited to speak. I think it's important. We're in a very crucial moment in our movement, not just for the Puerto Rican independence movement with the assassination of Filiberto Ojeda Rios, but tonight is an important night. It's a night of human rights, and it's a night of recognizing that they are new African political prisoners in the United States, and that we need to organize not just for their liberation, but to creating a new circle of unity between people of color that are in the struggle for national liberation.
For those that don't know, can you recap your case? Can you tell the people what happened? A history, even from Lolita and even before that, however far you want to take it. Can you give us like a brief history of the Puerto Rican independence movement?
Okay, Puerto Rico was invaded. Puerto Rico's been a colony first by Spain and then by the United States. The United States militarily invaded our nation in 1898. And from that day forward, it has maintained colonial rule over Puerto Rico. So Puerto Rico is really the oldest colony in the Western Hemisphere. What does that mean? That means that the United States government controls every aspect of the Puerto Rican life. Those of you that may have studied sociology or have not, the socialization of every Puerto Rican is its education, its health, its living condition. Who do we trade with? How do we live? All of this is controlled by the United States government. What does that mean? That it means that since the moment the Spaniards invaded Puerto Rico, we have the movement for Puerto Rican resistance and liberation starts way back. The Taino Indians had a resistance form. The Taino Indians and the black slaves that were left after the Spanish massacres of our people created the first revolutionary grupo, los Cimarrones. I happen to live in the area, which is called Luis Aldea, which is the swamplands, that was given to the black slaves after so-called freedom. The struggle for Puerto Rican liberation and national liberation has been a struggle of resistance. Because it's interesting to understand that the Puerto Rico is only an island 23 by 100 feet small. But we have been able to maintain our culture, maintain our language, and maintain our struggle of resistance for over 500 years. That's saying something about the Puerto Rican nation. There is a psychology and an internal being of resistance that is embedded in our genes, even though the United States has continuously attempted to kill our people, to take our language away, to take our culture away, and we have been embedded right now. I hadn't been in Puerto Rico 20 years, and after my freedom from prison, the fallen floor of Puerto Rico is embedded with concrete. So they're American investors, they're developing concrete condominiums, and they're forgetting about the real livelihood of the Puerto Rican nation. But what we have witnessed, and I was able to witness this year, September 23rd, which is the day we celebrate the colonialization of Spain, right? Which was the first revolutionary act called El Grito de Lares. Well, since Filiberto was assassinated on the same day, while his speech was being presented to thousands of Puerto Ricans that go to Lares, to the municipality of Lares, and attend all day's activities, that's when the FBI went in and assassinated Filiberto Ojeda. So my contention is that from this day forward, from 2005, we have a new Grito de Lares, which is against U.S. colonialism.
Can you give us a history of Filiberto? Who is Filiberto to the Puerto Rican movement and our human rights movement as a whole?
Filiberto Henarios was allegedly the head of the armed movement in Puerto Rico in the 70s and 80s. Filiberto was able, I mean, I think people have to understand that revolutionary violence is not about with intentions of killing people. Revolutionary violence has been used as to do political military acts so that people's eyes can be open and that the enemy know that the level of resistance has been raised. I think people have to understand too that was a different phase in our political development of the struggle for national liberation. To say the least, I don't know what the future will bring for Puerto Rico. Filiberto represents an armed combatant who for 15 years was clandestinity. And as I mentioned earlier, Puerto Rico is a small nation. And I always, while I was incarcerated, I did many interviews and people asked me, well, do people support the armed struggle? Well, it wasn't until August 30th, 1983 that an informant informed the FBI where some of the members of Machetero were, that they were then arrested, you know? And it wasn't until it had to be an informant who told the FBI where Filiberto was after 15 years. And what the FBI and the federal government did is they literally assassinated him because they really thought that at this moment in history, our Puerto Rican independence movement was divided and that we were weak. But I will tell you, the people that came in support of all the activities surrounding Filiberto's assassination, and I will say that we had letters of support, activities of support all over Latin America, places in Japan, here in New York City, all over the United States, but his funeral in Puerto Rico was that is said to be the largest funeral, even larger than Don Pedro Arvizu Campos' funeral. People from all walks of life, all ages, were on the streets, on the railroads, crossing, playing, saluting Filiberto's body, crossing the streets with placards and Puerto Rican flags that read FBI assassins, Viva Puerto Rico Libre, so that his assassination, contrary to their belief, has been like a new force of energy in our consciousness to have the spirit to win.
When was he assassinated? And primarily, why was he assassinated, for those that may not know?
Filiberto Henarios was assassinated September 23rd, 2005, at his home in clandestinity in Hormigueros, Puerto Rico. He was assassinated because he had been charged. He was put on an electronic monitor, and 15 years prior to September 23rd, he took it off and went back to clandestinity to continue the struggle.
Yes, ma'am. Do you have any concluding words for young freedom fighters out here today?
Well, I think that what we need to do to all our, and I call all our young people our freedom fighters, because to struggle for freedom and liberation, there are many ways of life that one does. I think you guys need to learn more about your history. You have to learn what is political consciousness. And I think we need to create a new collective consciousness of people of color that are struggling for the same cause, because the enemy is the same enemy. And the person who are oppressors is the same enemy. It's the same person. So that we also have to be able to honor ourselves and honor all of the people in all walks of life. And I'm talking about, sometimes there's a conflict about who's more black than the other and who's more revolutionary than the other. And I believe that the true revolution is a person that practices every day on the street, raising consciousness so that all the lies that were created and all the history books that have been creating lies about who we are as a people are cleared. The moment you young people know who you are, the moment you begin a liberation process.
Yes, ma'am. Appreciate you.
Peace.
This edition of the Black Report was produced and edited by the Minister of Information, J.R.
That was Puerto Rican nationalist Dilcia Pagan speaking with J.R. Valray in 2005. She participated in many social justice struggles and was one of the organizers of the Puerto Rican Student Union, an organization that promoted Puerto Rican studies, and the Puerto Rican Studies Center in New York City. Dilcia Pagan was born on October 15, 1946, in Bronx, New York. She made her transition on June 30, 2024, in Carolina, Puerto Rico, at age 77. For more on Dilcia Pagan, visit latinopia.com. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, Akua Holt, J.R. Valray, Don DeBar, Ann Garrison, and myself, Paulina Vasilyev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Paulina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.